printed paper.
Welcome to episode 36 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Lee Suggs, an artist based in Richmond, Virginia. I met Lee 10 years ago when she took a sculptural papermaking class with me at the Penland School in North Carolina. We talk about her upbringing with a mom who was an art professor, how she didn't think she'd ever be an artist, but how her life just kept going in that direction, and today she makes a living making paper art. She tells me about the process of applying to grad school and finding the right fit, both in terms of funding and discipline. And of course we chat about her work, which involves optical trickery. She's interested in getting us to think about how we see and how we use language to describe what we see. And we discuss a unique ongoing collaboration Lee has with two women she met during that session 10 years ago at Penland. Enjoy our conversation. Lee Suggs, welcome to Paper Talk. I remember meeting you, I think it was 10 years ago in 2009, at Penland in North Carolina. You took a workshop with me, and I have a lot of memories about that. It was great. So welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you and hear about your work. You do amazing things with paper. And let's start just talking a little bit about your childhood and how art was a part of it.
Sure. Yeah, my mom was an art professor at Appalachian State University. So yes, you were correct. We met 10 years ago at Penland, which is actually about an hour from where I grew up and from where my mom taught at Appalachian State. So I spent most of my childhood after school in her office, in her studio.
What was her medium?
She was a fiber artist, but she taught a lot of art history as well. So I like to say that it's sort of ingrained in me, but of course you don't learn that through osmosis. It's, you know, I think just being around it, it was normal to art making was, and when it wasn't offered in school, I was taking after art or after school art classes that were run through the university. So I was always doing something visual art related, all like my whole life. I can't even remember a time when I wasn't. So part of my childhood. Yes.
And did you do anything with paper as a child?
I think yes, but maybe not in the formal sense. I remember, you know, not having many supplies or materials. I would use office supplies or paper laying around in her office. I remember her having this old typewriter in her office as well that I would type on all the time and leave her notes and things that she stash them in books in her office. And I do remember one time she was teaching papermaking, and I think there was leftover supplies after her lecture that day and her demos that day. And so she taught me, but it was something so simple in a space that wasn't, you know, meant for papermaking, but never real formal, no. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then you studied art in college, is that right?
Yeah, so I think I went through every like teenage angst of like not wanting to do what my mother did.
Uh-huh.
And sort of rejecting those things that you know as normal and wanting to, you know, spread your wings and do something totally different. She really wanted me to go to an art school, but I was not that interested in pursuing art at 18 years old and wanted to go to liberal arts college. So I went to UNC Chapel Hill, and I took an art class with Beth Grabowski, who's a printmaker. My first semester freshman year. And it was sort of the first time they were doing these smaller classes. It was about 10 people, which was unusual for that university. I think most of their classes tend to be 20 to 100 or 200 people.
Wow.
Art classes, of course, were smaller, but like at a liberal arts college, that's huge. Their regular classes are hundreds of people. So I got a really intimate experience with her as a professor, but also with art making that was completely different. It was actually a bookmaking class, or sort of a printmaking bookmaking class. And that was really I remember that class being really informative. Mm-hmm. As much as I was rejecting art at the time, I really, really loved it. And I ended up taking multiple classes from her. She did a lot with paper, bookmaking, and, you know, not necessarily printmaking driven, but derivatives of that, which was really wonderful. And I think was sort of my first introduction into having interest in paper. And she actually put me in touch with a conservator that worked in one of the libraries on campus. And UNC Chapel Hill has a huge rare book collection. I think it's maybe one of the largest. So I got to work in the rare book collection with the preparator and conservator, repairing old books and manuscripts. So I was making boxes, repairing old manuscripts, and, you know, getting to touch and see things that, you know, you'd never, right. I mean, they're there at the university for people to look at, but I didn't know that was a resource there until I was working there. So I learned a lot about archival techniques. And I think those two things combined between what I was learning in my art classes and then that technical skill and knowledge led me to really have interest in more specifics about paper. But still, that was on the periphery. I wasn't, I was still maybe 19 or 20 at the time.
I have a question. Did you study art? Did you major in art?
Yes, of course.
Okay. So go on.
Yeah. I think by the end, maybe halfway through my sophomore year, I had enough credits in art already to have a minor.
Uh-huh.
So, and at that point, I think they were sort of encouraging me to go ahead and declare a major. So I just, by default, declared art as my major, even though I was still really wishy-washy about it. Mm-hmm. But I love doing it. I still to this day don't know why I was rejecting it so hard or avoiding it. And I did that. I mean, I avoided acknowledging art as my career for a very long time. While I was also in school, Juan Logan, another professor of mine, I think he was somehow tied to Dudonné at the time.
Uh-huh. Dudonné paper mill in New York City. Yeah.
Yes. He really encouraged me to apply for their work study program. And I had received a travel grant through school as an undergrad. And he encouraged me to use that money to do a summer in New York and to do the work study program at Dudonné.
Okay. So why did he encourage you? Were you doing work with paper?
I don't really remember.
Okay.
I must have been doing something paper specific. I remember doing large collages and making things with old books, like things that were readily available. I was deconstructing books and using that a lot.
Right. Okay. So you went to Dudonné and this was maybe 2001, 2002.
Yeah.
Okay. Cause I worked there until 98. So, or 97.
We just missed each other. But that was a really transformative summer. I mean, of course, being in New York City was pretty amazing and eye-opening. Being in a paper facility, like actually making paper, which I had not done up until that point in a more formal technical way, was amazing. I loved the like hands-on. There was still these goals and tasks that you had to do, which, you know, I enjoy of some regularity, but then there were all these amazing artists who were making these crazy things that you would never think were out of paper. So that, I think I could point a lot of my inspiration and my growth to that summer.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there were all those things leading up to that pushed me there. But I think seeing paper as a contemporary material and seeing other artists use it in a way that wasn't typical, was pretty eye-opening. So
right. And so then you finished college, and I think there was a pretty big gap between college and grad school.
Is that yes right? So, yes, quite a bit of time. I graduated in 2003 and then didn't 10 years. 2013 is when I came to Richmond. Right after college I was working retail for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a job with an architecture, an interior design firm, just working in the office, doing office managerial stuff. And in the beginning, it wasn't really stimulating, but was much better than working retail.
Right.
And I just sort of fell in love with the woman I worked for, her family, and all the employees there. And just, I ended up staying for quite a bit of time. Around 2005, the woman I was working for wanted to open up a gallery. And so she was putting together a house show in this house that she had just finished. It was this beautiful modern house and was hanging artwork in there and was inviting people to come in. So I remember frantically making work for that because she asked me to be a part of that. So it was about 2005 when I really started pushing and making work again. I took a little time off, but maybe not that much now that I'm probably felt like a lot longer to me in my head, but so she was really instrumental in sort of pushing me forward as well in my art career as well as in this business career that I had with her too. You have to make money and have health insurance and all those things. And I think being still really young, I wasn't sure how to do that as an artist. And in fact, I don't think it was even a thought that I could be an artist. I was 30 doing a winter residency at Penland. The power had gone out. It was pouring snow. You know, it was one of those real tranquil moments there.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden I just had this like epiphany of that, like people do this for a living. Like people make art all the time and this is what they do. And for some reason I'd never like accepted that or thought about that as an option for myself. And so from about 30 years old until I went to grad school, which I was 34, 35, maybe 32. 30.
You're still in your 30s, so it wasn't that. But I do want to comment on that. Yeah. I felt the same way. I knew I wanted to be an artist, but I never really thought of it as a career.
Yeah.
And I don't really know why either. Some of it I feel like perhaps, like my mother encouraged me to do art, but I don't know. I think my parents, so it's interesting that your mother was an art professor, but that's different than being an artist, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There was always this other thing she did.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she made art.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. So then, so I met you in here sometime before you went to graduate school. You came to Penland.
Yeah. 2009.
And so you're saying you had been there before as a resident or what?
So I've been a number of times in different capacities. I think taking your class might have been the first time I had been since I was in college, because I did go when I was in college. That was the first time. But I've been as an assistant. I've done their winter residency multiple times, and then I've since taught.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so let's start. This is a good segue into talking about your work and then grad school. So I remember one piece that you made in specific in my class, and you mentioned earlier that I know what you're saying. Listeners probably didn't catch it, but repetitive work or structure or something. So so you had this spherical form that you wanted to cover with little half spheres all over it. So it was probably over 100 of them or close to 100 of them. And you were going to make the paper in addition to creating the sculptural form. It turned out beautiful and we troubleshot and figured out how to do it. So talk about your work and then figuring out grad school and all of that.
Well, you're going to hate me. I just threw out that piece like literally like a month ago.
Oh.
I have had it for 10 years. I've been carrying it around with me, moving it with me. I used it as a lantern, that had a plug in, a light that,
I've thrown out work too. It's okay.
It had just collected so much dust that it was gross. And I felt like, time to purge. But, What was the second part of your question? Remind me of that part. I felt so guilty about throwing that away.
Oh, that's okay. When I met you, you were thinking about grad school. So I just want to sort of hear about that process. And like, did you apply to schools and get in right away, or were there some rejection and just kind of that whole?
Like I had said, the woman I was working for really pushed me in my art. I think what was happening in tandem in my job at that time was the market had just crashed, right, in 2008. Mm-hmm. And we were working on a huge mixed-use residential building that was like 98 units and I don't know how many countless retail. And that building ended up going into foreclosure in 2010. So mm-hmm. I had spent probably 5 or 6 years working on that project at, you know, in my mid-20s, and then watching it just basically die at the last moment. And that was really heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
And I think really hard to recover from. And I know that happens to architects and designers all the time. Just for some reason, putting all this energy into something and then it just sort of falling apart at the last minute was really devastating to me. So I think I had like a life realization moment of what do I really want to be putting my own energy into? And what was fulfilling me? And it was making artwork. So what would happen if I reversed the roles of job versus making art, and I was spending, you know, 8-10 hours a day making artwork and maybe 1 or 2 hours a day doing a job? Like, what would happen, you know, if I put that belief in myself and what I was doing? So I knew it would take me some time to get there, and I knew that grad school would be a bridge for that, because I also didn't know if I could handle making artwork all day, every day. Is like, would my brain just fry and frizzle, or would I really be energized? So I applied to grad school several times. I think I spent 2 or 3 years applying to schools, but I also didn't really know where I fit. Like, I'm not really a fiber artist. I'm not really a painter. I'm not really a drawer. I'm all these things, but there's, you know, when you have to check a box on an application, I wasn't sure which way to go. So my first year, I applied to a lot of like low residency programs where I could still do my job and go to grad school for a couple weekends and a couple months out of the year. And I did get into one of those programs, but I just decided it wasn't worth it. Like, like that didn't fit what I had thought about like switching the energy. And I had also gotten rejected from VCU, their painting and fiber department, and kept, I've applied there 2 or 3 times and then got into the fiber program and finally decided to go. My dad also at the time was sick and I wanted to be close to home. It was only 3 hours for me to drive back to North Carolina. So that was a big factor too, but yeah, it took me several tries and, but I held out for what I thought would be right for me and also held out for funding. That was my other goal, was to not go into debt. Like walking away from a career, I knew that I didn't want to walk away with debt from art school. Like it just didn't make sense to me. So I had funding all through grad school.
And do you think, is that common? I didn't go to grad school and I don't really have applying several times to the same place and then securing the funding. Was that because, or it just was the year and it worked out?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's all across the spectrum of that, of what you're saying, that, you know, I think people who are really excited to go will go and not hold out for funding. But at that point in my life, I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't do that.
Right.
You know, I'd sort of planned I'd probably need to take out some living loans, but I actually never had to. I was able to keep working a part-time job for the woman I had been working for years. Right. And that, you know, helped pay for rent and for food. And then I also worked on campus and then also ended up being a studio assistant for Sonia Clark for a year while I was in grad school. So I got all sorts of great experiences and, you know, I wouldn't change a thing, but I do know that grad school can be pretty rough on other people. And, you know, especially if you don't have funding, it's think that can be pretty depressing.
And so now you've been out of grad school 5 years?
Yeah, it'll be five years in May. Yeah.
Okay. And you're basically a full-time artist now.
Yeah.
And you have a studio outside of your home.
Yep.
And okay, so I'm excited to talk a little bit about your work, and people really have to look at your work. I was like, yeah, we should be doing this on video or something. But thanks for the internet. Everybody can look at it at leesuggs.com. So I was looking at the categories on your website, but what's a good way to sort of go through your work and talk about it?
Yeah, sure. I think at least for the last year, and maybe this is just heavy on my brain, but sort of what I was saying before, even applying to grad school, I never knew where I fit. Uh-huh. And I still have that problem of like, I'm a blend between all these things. And I guess I've sort of categorized my website as different bodies of work, and they all incorporate whatever it's drawing. I draw on all my work, actually, whether it's drawing, cut paper, or just paper sculpture. I don't know. I think that's a really good question about categorizing it.
Okay, we don't have
There's
to go
so
that
many ways.
We don't have to go that way. Let's talk about the concepts behind. So I know that you have this story about seeing, you know, when you close your eyes and you see things. So tell me about that.
I think one of my earliest pleasant memories, like visual memories, is about seeing these blue dots behind my eyes. I don't see them as frequently anymore unless I like manually rub my eyes or push on my eyelids or something. But I remember frequently seeing them as a child and thinking they were the most glorious thing ever. Mm-hmm. And so I've always drawn like circles or bubbles, always doodling. Somehow a circle has always been a thing. Mm-hmm. And I relate it to that. I mean, I think that's my connection for understanding the shape that my work sometimes takes to like a memory. But then in college when I was writing my thesis, because I was delving much more into like how language and like a visual representation of something, how completely off those two things can be. Mm-hmm. And I find that really fascinating that, you know, we all have these visual understanding of things, but it could be very different than how somebody's explaining it. So that language is a prohibitor and an inhibitor, that it plays in these funny ways with how we create an image of something in our mind. And so I was talking to my mom about this, and she said, well, you know, I have synesthesia, right? I was like, no, we've never talked about this.
Okay, so explain what it is.
So synesthesia is basically a crossing of senses. So it's sort of a neurological, I think it's awesome. I don't think it's a problem, but I know it is a problem for some people. But basically she reads in color. So like letters and symbols appear to her as colors. So like her A is always red, you know, and her S's. These are these bright yellows, and she's an avid reader, but I've never heard her talk about that being in color because it's normal to her.
Right.
And I was like, well, how did you know that like what you were envisioning and seeing was completely different? She said, I was talking to my roommate when I was in college, and somehow I said something about my A's being red, and she looked at me like I was crazy. So we just dropped the subject, but she was like, since, you know, later on done more research and figured out that it has a name. But I think that's so fascinating that she has such a visual, like, cacophony of colors when she's reading. And I don't know. It leaves me speechless to think about that, but I don't know. It's also this weird thing that the person who taught me my colors and my alphabet, did any of that transfer? I know I don't have what she has, but I find that really fascinating. And thinking about applying that to color theory and thinking about, you know, it's like the first sentence in Joseph Albers' book about, you know, if someone says the color red, the color that we're all envisioning, there's a chance that every single one's different.
Right.
So that's sort of the fundamental thought that I've trailed throughout all my research about this complication of language and visual information. So I'm not really always doing circles. I think now that I've gotten more into doing more geometric and, you know, more abstract imagery. So, I mean, that thread of visual trickery or visual manipulation is the underlying thread for everything.
So sort of like optical illusion is a more understandable phrase, maybe.
Yes, definitely.
For people listening.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, I want to talk about materials and then maybe think about a particular piece that you could describe making, and then we'll go all the way through the viewer's experience, and then people will have to go look at that piece online to see if we described it, if our language was
That's
accurate.
A great idea.
And at least you're describing it, so we can test you. I don't have to be blamed for anything. Just kidding.
I'm sure I'll fail. So,
so you do tons of cutting. Can we pick a cut out?
Sure.
So I really want to know about your tools and your materials. So what the range of papers and any weird ones you've used.
Yeah. So I think most of when I was really starting to cut paper, I was just cutting through cotton and or like printmaking paper, like not understanding the structure of the paper and how that might affect how much I might be cutting out. So like any short fibers, like the paper ends up falling apart and or is really difficult to cut through. So I've learned my lesson, even though I tend to go back and forth sometimes and cut papers that I hate, but
because you like the look of them or
sometimes, or like I've done some silk screening on paper and there's already a pattern or a print, and I've been using like French's paper or something like that. And I, but I hate cutting through it. It's really hard on your hand and it's like scratchy. Anyway, Abaca is one of my favorites. It's a very thin paper, easy to cut through, and the fibers are really long. So you can basically obliterate the sheet, you know, take all, you know, 90% of the paper away, and it still will hold its integrity and structure. So I'd say that's my favorite, but since I don't, and I've had you make me several sheets so that I've used for that, but, and Dudenay, I have them make sheets of paper for me. But my favorite right now is either Tyvek or Yupo, which are both synthetic papers, which I hate admitting that, but they really are really soft to cut through. Yupo specifically, it's like cutting through butter versus that scratchiness of, you know, a thicker cotton paper. And then Yupo also has a really strong, it's like really thinly extruded plastic. And it has a really thin sheet of like cheesecloth or some sort of webbing in the middle that basically allows the plastic to stay together.
And that, but that cuts well. You don't.
Oh yeah. You don't notice that webbing. You know, it's like a, it's almost like a really open mesh, and I think it's way more open than cheesecloth. Sorry, that's again bad language description. but the easiest way to. Like of how that's manufactured. And it's actually made in Virginia where I live, so I feel a little better about that. Yeah, I have my own internal debates about using synthetic papers, but for what I do, it works. And it's, I know that the longevity of the work is there. It's not going to degrade.
Yeah, do you know what Yupo is made of?
I think it's a PVC.
Yeah.
So terrible.
And does it come on a roll?
Or you can buy sheets. You can buy pads usually too at the art store that are like 8.5 by 11 or 11 by 17. So you could definitely can experiment with it, you know, in that smaller form. And then it comes in 30-inch wide rolls and 60-inch wide rolls.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about my upcoming online class called Flexible Book Structures. Do you crave the inspiration you get from the act of making? Love books and paper? Have a desire to connect with others who share these same goals? Join me in creating a series of flexible book structures that fold and unfold, collapse and expand, inflate and deflate. Let's wonder collectively about what a book is. We will create 6 book objects, the equivalent of a week-long workshop with me in person, during this 6-week online class, which begins April 10th. Work from the comfort of your own home or studio at any time throughout the week, and hop into the classroom to ask questions and share your projects and ideas in a supportive and creative online community. Watch my promotional video to learn more and register at helenhebertstudio.com/shop/flexible-book-structures-online-class. That's a mouthful. Now back to the episode.
Okay.
So one of the pieces I'll describe that I just did is off of a 60-inch wide roll. So I cut 2 60 by 60 sheets of paper. So big, we're talking big.
5 feet. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I do like a faux lamination of where I stack the two together. And I do a big drawing on one side, basically going back to the circles. Mm-hmm. So the circles are probably about 4 to 5 inches in diameter. And they're all sort of connecting. No, I'm just tracing around like a roll of tape, something just laying around in my studio. Mm-hmm. So they're all connected. They're all attached, like connecting at least on one or multiple more points. Like, so it's concentric circles sort of laid out on the 60 by 60 sheet. And then I was cutting out slices from inside of each circle. So each circle has like a line pattern, maybe going in different directions.
Okay, so I've seen this piece. What's the name of it so we can look it up?
It's called Own Place, O-W-N. Place.
Okay.
Yeah, so thinking again about like my own visions or my own personal space / place that I liked to go to. Mm-hmm. Okay, so back to describing it. So it's connected circles with lines that were, I cut out slices within the circle. So again, these two sheets are still attached to each other, sort of laminated together. So basically I'm making 2 at the same time.
Okay. So are they actually, how are they laminated? I'm going to be a geek on the paper.
Oh, I'm just like taping them together, like real basic.
Just around the perimeter?
Just around the perimeter.
Okay.
So and I have to be real careful. Yeah. About like
when you're cutting.
Yeah. When I'm cutting, making sure that the paper is totally flat and there's pressure on it.
Is it on a big table that you can walk all around? Cause that's big.
Yeah.
Do you have to like do any gymnastics to get to the center or it's close enough?
Sometimes, yes. Uh-huh. Sometimes I am up on my tables, like laying across the work.
Okay.
Other times I can roll it and pull it closer to where I'm sitting.
Right.
Closer to where I'm sitting. But
and one more question. I know it's blue. How does it get blue?
So after I've cut out all the like lines and the circles, I then cut away the spaces that were between each of the connecting circles.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking away basically the squareness of the paper. So now it's just these circles. And it really then becomes the 2 sheets. So basically it's 2 sheets cut at the same time. And then I just paint it afterwards.
Okay.
Sometimes I paint it before, but I really wanted to try switching the roles of those 2 things of cutting first and painting second. Versus painting first, cutting second. Because I was also really interested in this whole idea of like, what constitutes a painting? What constitutes a drawing?
Right. Like,
so pushing that in my own head. Wanting the paint brush strokes to be much more evident and the paint catching where the cutouts were. So the paint sort of globs up in some of the lines that are cut out of the circles. So actually, the last part of that piece is basically taking what was the top sheet, and then I flip it over, and I sort of offset them. So it creates a moiré pattern, or this like movement, because the lines then don't line up correctly anymore.
Okay.
So you're getting this op art.
Right.
eye shift, eye trickery thing happening.
And the whole shape, though, they're different when you flip one over.
Yeah, but
the outer shape, it's all different.
Yeah.
But it's similar in a way.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And so how far apart are they?
They're glued together at the top. Okay. So they're flattened, but only at the top. So then when you get to the bottom, they become more fabric-like and a little more wavy.
Uh-huh.
So there becomes more play down towards the bottom of the piece.
Right, right. And so I want to ask you, I don't want to forget something, though. I want to ask you about the knife you use for
just
cutting.
Just Exacto, if I can say a name brand.
Yeah.
Exacto and 11, number 11 blades. But I use these like old school, you know, those things you put around your pencils to like give a little squishy.
Right.
I do those, and then I've actually manufactured some like other squishy toys. A friend of mine did this for me that it's like actually a ergonomic, I think it's a manatee, a squishy manatee that we taped to this Exacto. Cause I, you know, I'm cutting for hours and my hand gets really fatigued. And I need something soft to push against. I know they probably make ergonomic ones. I just haven't. If anybody knows of any that listens to this.
It's funny how we get stuck in our own. I just did a little tutorial for an online class I'm doing about cutting with a knife.
Yeah.
And I use the same. And I don't even have the cushion. I don't cut as much as you, but there are a lot of fancy ones out there, but I've never found one. And then I just stopped looking. But so have you ever had hand problems? Do you do any exercises or do you limit how much time you spend cutting? Like, and how long did it take to cut those two?
So I think one of the best pieces of advice that Sonia Clark gave me when I was working with her was always have a bottle of water or a glass of water next to you while you're working and drink that constantly because it'll make you have to get up and pee. Like you can't sit there for hours doing the same thing, you know, which I think you either can do that or you can't. So if you can sit there and do something for hours, you need something that makes you stop to get up and move around. And at least like for me, I really worry about my own vision that I need to like transfer to looking at things far away versus things that are up close. So I always have water or tea. So I think getting up is a good exercise, but I have a pretty regular routine of going to the gym in the morning. And I try to really protect that time because I know as I get older and my body is not as resilient that, you know, staying active in other ways and moving my body in a different way is really important. Because I do sit and do the same thing quite often, you know, several days on end. Cause some of the pieces can take a month, 2 months.
Yeah.
And I may have like two or three things going at once that I can like, when I'm really tired of working on something, I can, you know, throw it to the side and do something else for a few hours. I need that mental break occasionally. Most of my things on average are at least 2 weeks, you know, it all depends on scale and intricacy, but right now with what I'm doing, most things take a few weeks.
I want to talk about where you show and sell your work, but first let's go with how the viewer experiences your work. So like this piece that we're just talking about, has that's been displayed and people have interacted with it?
Yes. So Own Place was just, I made that for my solo show at my gallery here in Richmond that opened back in November and closed right before the holidays.
And what's the name of the gallery?
Reynolds Gallery.
Okay.
They've been here in Richmond for 30, 40 years, quite a long time. You know, it was one of those places that when I was in grad school that I was like, okay, 5 years after grad school, I feel like I'll be able to approach them. And luckily, a professor of mine, while I was in school, he actually coordinated a studio visit and a meeting with them. And they actually loved my work, thankfully. Oh. And, so I've been showing with them since 2014. So I was halfway through grad school, and they took a lot of the work I had been making prior to grad school. And then I did a solo show with them right after grad school, which I think was one of the articles you read.
Okay. Yeah.
That we can put a link up to as well. So they're my bread and butter. I mean, being local and having a really close relationship with them, they are placing my work in corporate collections, but also selling to, you know, into private collections as well.
And you have a solo show with them every couple of years, or?
Yeah. They usually rotate like 2 to 3 years.
Okay.
Right. So yeah, but so the way their gallery is set up is their ground floor is they do 2 solo shows at a time.
Okay.
And maybe do a group show once or twice a year down and on that bottom floor. But then upstairs they have their regular roster of artists where they rotate work constantly. So I'm able to have something usually on display on a regular basis mm-hmm. there, which is pretty wonderful. And I feel really fortunate about. And then the woman who I was working for in North Carolina, she has a gallery, and she still sells my work. So, that's wonderful that I can send work there too, still. And then, I show with the Penland Gallery as well, mm-hmm. which I have quite good ties with still. I go there quite often. And then the art advisors and, you know, some random people that either find my work online or have seen my work in shows. But I also travel, like send work out quite a bit to group shows in other cities.
Right. And I'm just curious, I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this, so say what you want. But I'm curious how much you plan a year out, or are you planning in terms of like how much work you need to sell versus how much income you need? Do you think about that at all, or?
Oh yeah.
Is it just happening? So you consciously.
Well, like for this solo show that I just had, I wanted to know what X amount retail dollars of my work in one room would look like. And it was, you know, I put a high bar for that for mm-hmm. me because I'd never done that. And I think, you know, I do think business wise quite a bit.
Yeah.
But you can't, you know, at some point you can't, like, I don't know, you can't force people to buy your work, you know?
Right, you can't predict how much it's going to sell. Right.
Exactly. So at least for me, my equation has sort of always been, as long as I'm showing and I'm constantly active of making and active and responding to people and having my stuff together, you know, ready to send to people, like that always comes back in my favor in one way or another, whether it's, you know, a curator mentioning me to somebody else and that just gains me another connection or another person who's interested in my work to actually booking a show or selling work. Mm-hmm. So I really try, even if I'm not selling, I'm still making and I'm still really, you know, moving forward. It's still, you can't stop. I mean, right. You have to keep it rolling. I'm sure there's going to be a point in time when it doesn't roll. I think that happens to every artist, that there's ebbs and flows to people being interested in your work. But yeah, you know, I'm just hoping that never happens.
Yeah, I think, I like what you're saying about always doing all the parts.
You know, right now, I intentionally have a really quiet winter because I'm just coming off of 3 shows that mm-hmm. happened in October, November, December, that were all different bodies of work. So I spent last year really cranking it out for those 3 shows, and then I'm having some quiet time right now and trying to write grants, just preparing for the time when work might not be selling.
And so what are the grants for?
The grants are basically for
just money
right? Keep working.
Okay.
You know, it costs money.
Yeah.
I applied for the Low Prize, which is a international craft mm-hmm. award, just stabbing at, you know, hoping maybe something will stick. And then there's a fellowship here in Virginia every year. And I've applied to that probably 6 or 7 times. So one day that'll happen.
That's really important to say. I wasn't asking specifically about which units. I just meant that that's a part of your package. And rejection is common.
Oh, yeah.
Trying again and again pays off in the end. Yeah.
And I think that is true in art making as well, that you have to keep trying and trying again. If something fails, like of mm-hmm. me trying to cut through all these different papers and then finally find something that works and or you like and you go with it. And I think people then will see that or recognize that, just as in if you're working hard and you just keep going, like people recognize your energy and your efforts.
Right, right. I want to go back. We kind of went off on a tangent, and sure. I want to go back to the viewer's experience of Own Place or another work, if there's another one that really was like a strike.
No, I think we can stick to that one.
Okay.
Cause all of them are fairly similar. I guess also the asterisk forewarning of like looking at an image online is also the irony of what I talk about in my work, that mm-hmm. it's really impossible to visually understand something just through a flat image or through language description.
And you mentioned the paint blobs.
Yeah.
When you said that, I was like, oh, yeah, I didn't even.
You wouldn't notice it.
Flat, airbrushed or something. So those subtle things are really hard to capture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just the same as it's really hard to photograph my work. Mm-hmm. So I find that to my disadvantage more than to my advantage. I don't think that irony works because most of what either you're applying for or using images for, it doesn't quite translate. So seeing the work in person is, I think, the best way to experience it. But, you know, that can only happen for so many people.
And it sounds like it draws you in.
Yeah.
I think there's a visual interest maybe, and then when you get there you start noticing all kinds of other things.
I'm thinking about these like personal own places or own experiences, but trying to make them universal or outward, or this like subdued contained object that somebody can finally see. I keep working bigger and bigger. I used to work fairly small, but you know, I want this idea of something so encompassing, at least in your field of vision. So for Own Place, you can stand and look at it from across the room and get that moiré visual effect and see it just for that pureness of optical trickery. Mm-hmm. But then as you get closer and, you know, you're maybe a few feet away from it, it encompasses your entire field of vision. So that's getting closer to, like, me trying to imprint what I think I see or what I think I thought I saw, you know, in somebody else's field of vision. But also then you start to see the paint, you know, where this process of like where I actually painted the surface, and you can see the brush strokes or the paint globbing in the corners. But still at that point, you're not sure whether this is 2 sheets of paper or like 500 circles that have somehow been attached to each other.
So right, which is what I thought when I saw the piece. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's an illusion in the process, and there's an illusion in the visual experience as well.
Right. And do people comment on that? The sense you just described of getting close to it and it being all around you?
I think people who can get past the like, oh my God, how many hours did this take you? Cause that's the first question I always get asked, and can experience the work as the work.
Right.
But normally, you know, 90% of the time, the questions are always about how long and, oh my God, you're crazy. I'm like, you sit at your desk all day too for, you know, 8 or 9 hours doing your job, and that's normal. Like, that's just
exactly
what I do.
Right. Yeah, good for you. Okay, let's wrap up with talking about this show. I know, I think at Penland, the same year I met you, you met some other artists, and you guys have kept in touch, and you just had a collaborative show. And so I'm kind of interested in the, the relationships and the making and how you collaborate together.
Yeah, so in 2009, when we were taking your, I think it was sculptural paper, I don't remember the title something of your class, something like that. I met two people, Jessica Hykus, who was at Penland at the time doing the CORE program, which is a 2-year program where you live on campus and take classes. So she was there living. And then Emmy Bright, who I forget where she was living at the time. She's now in Detroit and teaches at Cranbrook, but we were all sitting in proximity. I think I was maybe in the middle. Emmy was behind me, and maybe Jessica was in front of me, just by happenstance, you know. I think about this a lot, too, that this is how young children meet. You meet people in class.
Right.
Because you're sitting beside them. And we've stayed in touch for the last 10 years. We've all since gone to grad school, since taking your class. We've all moved. You know, had gotten married or broken up with people, you know, so our lives obviously have continued on, but we've sort of stayed in contact, at least through artwork and through art conversation, for the last 10 years. And probably 3-4 years ago, we finally decided, like, let's get back together. Maybe we just rent a cabin somewhere and we make artwork for a week or 2 weeks, like make our own residency kind of thing. And then I suggested, let's just do this Penland winter residency. They open up their studios during the winter time for sort of open practice. There's not, there aren't classes that are going on. And so that was an easy place for us to sort of reconvene, because that's also where we met. And we had no idea what this was going to look like or even what we were doing, but it was sort of a, let's just see each other again and see what happens. And after 2 weeks of working together, we all were like, let's do a show. Like, I think we've got something here. But then there was all that self-doubt of, like, maybe we're just twins speaking here, where the three of us have been so insular with each other that, like, you know, would other people understand this, like, cross collaboration or working in tandem? Because we weren't really working in collaboration. We were all working individually, but then bringing our work together and seeing what overlapped. And then we'd go back to our studios and make work sort of branching off of that conversation. So for 2 years, we built a body of work based on this concept of where are things connecting between the three of us and letting it naturally and organically happen. So we sort of wrote a, you know, prospectus proposal thing to pass out to galleries to see if anyone would bite. And then there's a nonprofit here in Richmond that was very interested in what we were doing, as far as like the collaboration part goes, because they're also an education facility and they offer classes. And so that was wonderful that they picked up the show, and they had a budget, provided us with shipping and things like that. So we, you know, there were some logistical things that financially were really helpful. But I think what really developed out of this was this idea of, I think Emmy describes it best, of this like political relationship with each other, that we're actually like supporting each other's ideas. So it's a new way of collaborating closely, but we're like, we're not forcing a collaboration per se. And we also, we've done these exercises too to sort of try to force things. And sometimes that worked and sometimes that didn't. Like, there was one exercise we all did with each other where we gave each other a different material. Like, I told them they had to use Yupo paper and X-Acto knife. And they both made these really beautiful things that they never would have made. Right. And Emmy did the same thing of where I had to use like a Xerox machine and blow something up, enlarge something that was real small, which was part of her printmaking process. But I hated working with copy paper. Back to my paper snobbery. Uh-huh. But that has led me to like have some interest in creating material from a printmaking standpoint, of where Emmy's actually helped me do some printmaking. So I can have this raw material that I can then use to cut up and use in different ways in my own work. But so like we are making our individual work, but then like sort of like colliding with each other or forcing each other to do these different things. So it's been pretty powerful and really wonderful addition to my own studio practice that allows me to think in a different way and make in a different way. So we're really hoping the show will travel to each of our home cities. That's our idea.
Your next step. Cool.
Yeah. So hopefully Kansas City, which is where Jessica is. We're hoping that's our next stop. Yeah.
Now, yeah. I noticed one image. I was looking at pictures of that show, and I was curious whether there's a piece that looks, and this is just an impression, like a towel pinned up on the wall with paper cutting.
Mm-hmm.
Is that yours?
It's the black and white that looks like a sort of a cone shroud shape. Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's on Tyvek with tape. So I was working a lot with the idea of blankets and pattern as disguise.
Uh-huh.
Thinking a lot too about razzle dazzle ships. You guys should look that up if you don't know about it. It's kind of the opposite of camouflage. It's meant to cause distraction. So it's sort of like a zebra with black and white stripes.
Okay.
It's meant to cause distraction, not blending in. Or confusion, distraction or confusion. So I was working a lot with black and white and pattern, but thinking a lot how blankets that we wrap up in them for protection, or like if you drape it over your head, like you're a ghost that you're hiding, but also in these black and white patterns, you're totally like calling yourself out and not disappearing. So,
right. And
I'm linking that to the idea of relationships of like, how do you disguise yourself, or how do you like try to fit in or blend in. So we were all working in some way with relationships and where you lose yourself and where you like actually become a part or a new part of self with another person, whether it's family or, you know, friendships or romantic relationships.
Cool.
Yeah.
And let's just wind up with what you're working on right now, because I've been seeing some pictures on Instagram, I think.
Oh, yeah. So those are actually silkscreened stripes that I did with Emmy. Mm-hmm. So I have, like, stacks of paper with stripes on them. But I've been painting these, like, blobs, which are actually floaters. I have quite a few floaters in my eye, but it's... Okay. Trying to like, how do I portray that to other people? I think floaters are real common. I think most people have them, but how can you make something look like it's imprinted or there, but not really there? So these striped paper with these blobs painted, and then I'm going back and cutting out the paper. So there's pattern removed. And like some of the floater parts are also removed, but you still see maybe the outline of it. It's still really present, but also really not there either. So still playing with this idea of what are you seeing? What are you not seeing? And what's there? What's not there?
Yeah. Well, this has been really fascinating. I could talk to you for hours, Lee.
Oh, great. But yeah, me too. Thank you.
We'll stop here. And thanks for your amazing work, and it's been such a pleasure to watch you over the last 10 years, and I hope to talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and if anybody else wants to follow me on Instagram too, we'll make sure that's up on your website.
Yeah, so you're at leesuggs.com, and what are you on Instagram?
Just at leesuggs.
And it's leighsuggs. Mm-hmm. All right, bye now.
Bye, thank you.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.
Besides the season, the main contender.